1906, started off as something of a technical school. By the 1930s, it had become much more than that, training the upper and middle class young in medicine, law, veterinarian science, forestry, and the humanities. Of course, when anti-colonial trouble arose, as it always did, the French closed classrooms. The Indochinese University shut down after the 1908 revolts, but it reopened and went on to become the Vietnamese National University in 1945 and operates to this day in Hanoi. Whatever its republican pretensions, French education in colonial Vietnam was not always secular, assimilationist, egalitarian, and much less a nation-building enterprise. Scores of religious schools, Catholic, Protestant, and Buddhist ones, operated quite independently, in contrast to religious school establishments in France. There was no attempt to use education to create a homogeneous Vietnamese identity. By the 1930s, the French had opened classes to train Highland bureaucrats and teachers in their own languages, or French, but not in Vietnamese. The École Sabatier produced Highland nationalists, equipped with their own Romanized languages, who went on to oppose Vietnamese nation-builders. The large Chinese community built their own schools and taught classes in Chinese, and in several dialects. Moreover, the widespread idea that the Third Republic wanted to turn young Vietnamese schoolchildren into French men and women is an oversimplification. By the 1930s, Orientalist-minded administrators of the Third Republic sought to use the school to reroute the Vietnamese youth in their patriotic traditions so that they would not become déracinés, uprooted. Vichy colonial educators followed suit. French schools across Indochina might have taught elite Vietnamese children that their ancestors were the Gauls, but the French were just as content to teach the majority of young Vietnamese in the majority Franco-Vietnamese schools that they were orderly-minded Confucians with their roots in the village. And while Vietnamese and French students intermingled and developed friendships in elite lycées, school clubs, and sporting activities, racial lines were real, and income disparities overwhelmingly favored the children of the colonizers. Marguerite Duras may have grown up dirt poor in rural Indochina and transgressed colonial hierarchies in Saigon by dating a rich Vietnamese boy, but her experience was the exception, not the rule. Nor were Franco-Vietnamese schools democratic in their social reach among the Viet majority. In all, during the interwar period, only 10% of the school-aged Vietnamese population actually went to school. Attendance rates were much lower in rural Vietnam, where a lack of financial support forced the poor to make greater sacrifices or forego education for their children altogether, and with it, any chance of upward social mobility. The children of the urban Vietnamese bourgeoisie, former mandarins, and new administrators always did better. Better off and socially well-connected families sent their children to the best schools to take up new positions in the colonial state as lawyers, health officials, nurses, interpreters, telegraph and telephone operators, veterinarians, agricultural specialists, teachers, and journalists. Unsurprisingly, most of modern Vietnam's nationalist elite came from the cities and these better-off classes. Ho Chi Minh and Ngo Dinh Diem were the fortunate sons of mandarins who studied at the National College in Hue, where Paul Bo had first introduced parts of the Franco-Indigenous curriculum. Despite all these limitations, the colonial educational system still stimulated great change. Although dropout rates for poorer students were high, the new education system nonetheless spread Quoc Ngu into the countryside and working-class urban neighborhoods, democratizing the written language in ways which the earlier character-based systems had never achieved. General Nguyen Binh had dropped out of school in third grade, but not before learning how to read and write. He had devoured the Romance of the Three Kingdoms in his free time as a teenager and went on to wield a pen as effectively as the sword as an adult. Secondly, colonial education fostered the birth of a new urban intelligentsia, numbering about 5,000 individuals in the mid-1920s and climbing to 10,000 by the eve of the Second World War. Its members were largely the products of the Franco-Vietnamese schools, at ease in French and Quoc Ngu. They, in turn, could rely on a mainly literate urban population of 550,000 people by 1937 who could buy their newspapers, novels, poems, and paintings. Thirdly, colonial education opened the doors to the other half of the Vietnamese population, women. Vietnamese girls of all ethnicities obtained the right to study, even in the same classrooms with boys, simply unthinkable under the former Sino-Vietnamese system. The daughters of wealthier families always went furthest. Henriette Bui Quang Chu, the daughter of the constitutionalist leader, went through this new educational system and on to France to become Vietnam's first woman doctor in 1934. Lastly, through a combination of school teaching, Quoc Nu, and modern means of communication, more and more Vietnamese discovered for themselves new scientific ideas, technological advances, literary models, poetic forms, and philosophical horizons. The printing press and newspapers probably did as much as the new education system to clear the way for a cultural risorgimento during the interwar years. The French had first brought printing presses to help run the colonial state in the Quoc Nu script. Founded in 1865, the government's official bulletin for Cochin China, the Gia Dinh Bao, immediately began circulating decrees with trusted Vietnamese interpreters and administrative allies at the helm like Truong Vinh Ky and Hoi Tinh Kua. First trained in Catholic missions in Penang, these men also used the government bulletin and the printing press to start publishing on a wide range of socio-cultural matters. More presses spread as the colonial state expanded into Annam and Tonkin. Backed by the government, in 1892, François-Henri Schneider opened what became the largest private printing and publishing house in Indochina and joined forces with none other than Nguyen Van Vinh to establish a string of newspapers, translations, and diverse publishing projects. Trained as an interpreter and an administrator, Vinh, like so many others, went on to open his own papers like the Trung Bac Tam Van, Northern Central News, and the Dong Duong Tap Chi, Indochina Review. While the French helped finance his papers and others in order to detach the Vietnamese from their East Asian cultural orbit and ally them with the French one, Vinh saw in Quoc Nu print media the chance to unleash a cultural revolution on very Vietnamese terms. Keenly interested in technology, he began pushing ideas first promoted by the leaders of the Tonkin Free School, Dong Khen Nhie Tuc. Like Phan Chu Trinh, he wanted to do away with Chinese characters, literary allusions, syntax, and what he saw as an embarrassingly outdated Vietnamese tradition and cultural practices. He championed the liberation of the individual from the suffocating hold of Confucianism. He translated scores of articles and books into Quoc Nu, including the first translations of The Tale of Kieu and The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, as well as Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels and Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. Like the Internet today, it is hard to underestimate the importance of the development of modern print media for spreading ideas to larger numbers of people at higher rates of speed. By the mid-1920s, several Quoc Nu papers had daily print runs of 15,000 copies. The woman's journal, Phụ Nữ Tam Văn, Modern Women's News, sold 8,500 copies daily between 1929 and 1931. And lest we forget, these papers passed from one reader to another. Actual readerships were always higher than the number of copies sold. Between 1923 and 1944, of the 10,000 published titles on official record, 20% dealt with religious topics, prayer books, rituals, Bibles, 24% were novels and short stories, 19% covered traditional literature, folk tales, poetry, and satire, and 6% related to theater, especially the southern form called Cai Luang. Little wonder that Vietnamese, like the Marxist lexicographer Dao Duy An, no longer had to go abroad to China, Japan, or France to tap into the revolutionary ideas moving across the globe. Much of it was at his fingertips in Quoc Nu, French, or in the Chinese papers he could read and buy in Hanoi and Saigon. And like the Vietnamese Communist Party's security services battling the web today, the French colonial police censored written material heavily. and tightly controlled the licensing of papers and presses, but they could not stop the accelerating globalization of new ideas, of which the French themselves were as much a part as their colonies were. Religious leaders also realized the power of what the French had done by pushing Quoc-Nous, widening education, and introducing the printing press and newspaper. They probably started promoting literacy among the masses a decade before urban-based nationalists launched the Association for the Dissemination of Quoc-Nous, Hoi Troyim Bachu Quoc-Nous, in 1938. Unlike the Indian National Congress, however, Vietnamese bourgeois parties like the Constitutionalists never truly grasped the need to use Quoc-Nous print media to reach into the countryside, where 90% of the population still lived in 1945. Their newspaper, La Tribune Indochinoise, Indochinese Tribune, never appeared in Quoc-Nous. Despite attacks from Phan Chu Trinh, Nguyen Van Vinh, and younger cultural militants, Confucianism experienced a revival via the print media. Major cultural figures of the time, such as Tran Trong Kim, Pham Khoeng, and Phan Khoi, as well as reform-minded mandarins about whom we know less, vigorously debated about Confucianism, its role in Vietnam in the past, how to retailor it to the needs of the country in the rapidly changing present, or whether to discard it entirely. Pham Khoeng saw in a renovated Confucianism the chance to remake the monarchy up above and hold the family together down below. Through both, he hoped to preserve the country's social fabric in the face of communism, individualism, and rapid westernization. Always fearful of Vietnamese nationalism, even among their closest collaborators, the French did little to help their bourgeois allies transform Confucianism into a unifying ideology, as the president of China, Chiang Kai-shek, was doing with the New Life movement. In 1934, when Pasteur ended the first Bao Dai solution, he also closed Pham Khoeng's intellectual journal, Nam Phong, Southern Wind. Others, like the inimitable Nguyen Van Tho or Tran Trong Kim, saw in reformed Confucianism an East Asian humanism capable of reconciling the community and the individual in a new national form. Man was perfectible, and Confucianism was not necessarily a conservative ideology, incapable of change. Nguyen Van Tho may have dressed in Confucian garb and worked at the École Française d'Extrême-Orient on ancient history, but he was also deeply involved in his present organizing Quoc-Nous campaigns in the 1930s, serving as a municipal advisor for Hanoi and writing prolifically in intellectual journals in the early 1940s. He showed no interest in Vichy's cultural politics during the Second World War and had no faith in the French resurrection of the very monarchy they had killed repeatedly. He joined Ho Chi Minh's nationalist government in 1945, helped to develop its educational service and literacy campaigns, and served in the First National Assembly. If young westernized Vietnamese had lampooned his traditionalism in the 1930s, this fiercely anti-colonialist Confucian humanist, who was the first to condemn the French use of torture in 1946, commanded only respect from 1945. Sadly, he disappeared during the French attempt to wipe out Ho's government in late 1947. Despite modest urbanization across the whole of French Vietnam, it was Hanoi and Saigon that were the sites where westernization, consumerism, and cultural change occurred most intensely. Bicycles and tramways, followed by automobiles and buses, transformed the way people moved about. Rubber-wheeled rickshaws, first imported from Japan, became a part of everyday urban life for Europeans and Asians alike. Streetlights went up while sewer systems went in. Cafes, theaters, concert halls, botanical gardens, and cinemas appeared, offering films in French, Vietnamese, Chinese, and even English, as Hollywood eyed a global market. Charlie Chaplin visited the colony in the 1930s to the thrill of all. European trends in food, drink, and medicines seeped imperceptibly into local practices. The Vietnamese words for butter, bo, and bread, ban, derive from the French words beurre and pain. The delicious Vietnamese sandwich, banh mi, owes much to the French baguette. By the 1920s, taking walks, gardening, attending the theater, and creating clubs seemed only natural for bourgeois Vietnamese and the fashionable youth who could afford it. Even the less fortunate could catch a glimpse of the big screen, though they had to watch from special partitioned sections known as les avancées. Vietnamese sartorial tastes westernized during the colonial period as wealthy men put on sports coats and button shirts, and women slipped into dresses and even wore shorts as sports took off and physical education became mandatory in schools. Tennis and football, soccer, became Vietnamese passions and remain so to this day. Nguyen Cat Thuong, or Le Meur, took fashion trends in Europe and combined them with earlier Vietnamese styles of dress, like the Ao Nu Tan, five-paneled body gown, to come up with such original creations as the Ao Dai. This long dress falls elegantly over the woman's entire body, descending from a snugly buttoned collar at the top to a more loosely fitted lower robe flowing over the waist, down the legs, and to the ankles. While the Ao Dai first took off in Tonkin, southern women in Saigon were the ones to make it famous, and those Vietnamese who were overseas after 1975 ensured that it remained a symbol of national elegance until it made a comeback in post-communist Vietnam. As Le Meur explained in his approach, in the old days people dressed basically to conceal their bodies, so they always presented a baggy appearance. But now one should dress so the body is present in a natural manner, or sometimes to modify it a bit so it appears more flowing and graceful. None of these sartorial trends moved in straight lines, though. Well into the 20th century, Vietnamese officials and even bourgeois men in the more westernized Cochin China could slip into the traditional collar-buttoned tunics and hats when it suited them or the occasion. Nor did trends simply flow out from the metropole to the colonies, but also the other way round, as Vietnamese influences in French fashion, cuisine, and art demonstrate to this day. Asian influences within Vietnam never disappeared. Indian-styled garments continued to find customers in Saigon and Hanoi, among both the Indian community and the Vietnamese. The writer Vu Trong Phung loved to sport his Indian-made shirt. The southern Vietnamese often relaxed in Cham or Khmer-inspired sarongs at home. While the Vietnamese bourgeoisie may have used Western cutlery as a social signifier when eating à la française, rich and poor alike continued to use chopsticks, eat white rice from a bowl, and enjoy a full soup as they had for centuries. Chinese and Vietnamese cuisine remained as popular as ever and won over many in the French community. Smoking Western brand cigarettes certainly took off, but many, mainly northern, Vietnamese men still inhale a potent type of nicotine tobacco through bamboo water pipes, a practice collectively known as Thuoc Lao. My first Vietnamese language instructor brought his water pipe all the way from Hanoi to DeKalb, Illinois, in the late 1980s. I have never missed anyone the way I missed Thuoc Lao, is how one folk song describes its power. My instructor would have agreed entirely. While urban women broke with the practice of chewing betel and areca nuts in favor of cultivating the pearly white teeth they saw in countless advertisements and beauty magazines in the 1920s and 1930s, these nuts still find their place in marriage celebrations, New Year festivities, and as offerings on altars dedicated to deceased family members. The Cultural Revolution of the 1930s, the Self-Reliance Movement. The renowned scholar of Vietnam and China, Alexander Woodside, is right to insist upon the importance for the 20th century Vietnamese of finding new ideologies and forms of social organizations which were capable of reconciling the individual with a society that French colonialism and globalizing forces had shaken so deeply. Some sought to find new forms of community along political lines, with modern nationalism never far from their minds. Communism and republicanism attracted others. Religion, millenarianism, and secret societies offered hope for just as many, while charities, sports, and professional associations worked for others. We have touched upon these questions elsewhere in this book. Here we need to add another ism, that of individualism, for it was at the heart of the Cultural Revolution that burst forth in Hanoi in the early 1930s, shifted to Saigon in the 1950s and 1960s, and continues today. In its simplest form, individualism emphasizes the independence, self-reliance, and liberty of a human being to determine his or her destiny. Freedom of choice and freedom of action serve as guiding principles. Individualism does not necessarily lead to anarchy, but it does require social, religious, and political systems to respect a human being's freedom of choice as long as this person does not harm the liberty of others. Individualism is related to humanism, which stresses the individual worth of human beings as well as their ability to improve themselves and society through rational thought instead of blind trust in religious faith. However, humanism and individualism are not the unique products of the European Renaissance. Confucianism in East Asia also stresses the perfectibility of man and does so in secular, rational ways, respectful of the individual. Younger Vietnamese coming of age in the interwar period, however, latched on hardest to Western individualism. Most were largely uninterested in the humanist, reformist-minded take on Confucianism, which Nguyen Van Thieu and Tran Trong Kim advocated. By the 1930s, thanks to their mastery of French and Quoc Nhu, young Vietnamese had access to the canon on Western individualism that had spread to East Asia by the early 20th century. They could read it in French or in Quoc Nhu translations, but there was also a Chinese connection. Because many of these Western-educated Vietnamese heralded from Mandarin families, many could read Chinese characters and would have been able to follow the new cultural movement young Chinese had initiated after the First World War. One of the staunchest defenders of human liberty in Vietnam, Phang Khoi, closely read the works of China's greatest humanist writer and cultural revolutionary, Lu Xun. Individualism provided young Vietnamese with a new foundation for creating a culture in which the toi, the I or the me, could find his or her rightful place in the family, society, and world. Confucianism, this generation claimed, had impeded the emergence of individual freedom, and in so doing, blocked the modernization of the country and its ability to exist on an equal footing with the West. Only the Vietnamese youth could lead this cultural revolution, for their parents, in their view, had failed miserably. This was certainly the conclusion Lu Xun's generations had reached in the wake of China's humiliation at the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919. In his condemnations of Franco-Vietnamese collaboration, Nguyen An Ninh drew a similar parallel for Vietnamese youth. In 1922, he told young Vietnamese that change could only come about with the liberation of the individual from the suffocating hold of the old order. You must struggle against your milieu, against the family that paralyzes your efforts, against this vulgar society weighing you down, against the narrow, hampering prejudices that stop at every turn your actions, against ignoble, humiliating, terribly humiliating and lackluster ideals which lower our race with every passing day. The greatest idealists have always counseled those who want to follow them to leave the house of their fathers, and we too, the youth today, must also leave the house of our fathers. We must leave our family, free ourselves from this society, separate from our country. That is to say that once we, the enemies who have been given the chance to be conscious of our own worth, the highest possible form of worth being that of the individual and the law governing the world, then we will return to Annam. Of course, individualism was political. Nguyen An Ninh's efforts to promote individual liberties went hand in hand with national liberation and landed him in jail on several occasions. The young leader of the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, Nguyen Thai Hoc, shared the Republican dream. The French smashed the VNQDD's uprising in Tonkin in 1930 and executed Hoc, suppressing a series of peasant revolts concentrated in Annam at the same time. The severity of this colonial repression was such that it shifted radical politics to Cochin China for the rest of the decade. Given the more liberal press laws in the Cochin Chinese colony, Nin would militate in favor of political pluralism and workers' rights in the pages of La Lutte in Saigon until his final arrest on the eve of the Second World War. Realizing that politically minded papers in Anam Tonkin didn't last very long, and in the wake of this repression, many young Vietnamese in the North focused their attention on promoting a cultural revolution. Leading the charge was Nguyen Thuong Tham. He joined forces with a core group of like-minded intellectuals, including his brothers Nguyen Thuong Long, Hoang Dao, and Nguyen Thuong Lan, Thach Nam, and a close friend, Trang Khang Yu, better known as Cai Hung. Tham adopted an appropriate nom de plume, Nat Lin, free spirit. The children of former Mandarin families, they were all highly educated, perfectly at ease in French and Quoc Nu, and could read Chinese. Cai Hung had graduated from the Lycée Albert Soreau, Nat Lin from the Lycée du Protectorat. The latter initially joined the colonial civil service, but his love of literature and the newspaper world proved too strong. He left for France in the late 1920s, where he pursued his literary interests, discovered the power of humor, and expanded his knowledge of the print media. Famous for its biting satire, defense of individual rights, and state-of-the-art cartoons, the French weekly Le Canard Enchaîné, The Chained Duck, found an enthusiastic admirer in him, his entourage, and a wide variety of Vietnamese readers. Starting in 1932, this core group established the literary self-strengthening movement. It opened its doors to like-minded intellectuals, artists, writers, poets, and cartoonists. They established two equally notable Quoc Nu newspapers to administer their assault on Confucian tradition and in defense of the individual, Phong Hoa, culture, and Nay Nai, these days. From 1932 to 1940, the editors wrote and commissioned scores of articles on the need to remake Vietnamese culture, overturn Confucianism, promote Westernization in its place, break with antiquated cultural practices, and liberate the individual through poetry, literature, art, film, dress, sports, and the like. Cai Hung put it best when he affirmed that the individual is in the process of achieving liberation, of breaking with the oppressive structures that had, by fooling him, led him down the wrong path. The individual must decide for himself. Irreverence flew off the pages of the first issues of Phong Hoa and Nay Nai as TLVD's soldiers mobilized. Never had satire and human been used with such devastating effect. Li Thoat, the woefully outdated Confucian, was an immensely popular figure for caricature, appearing in issue after issue. He served as the visual whipping boy for the group's attack on all that was outmoded. The Tuluk Vandone ripped into those whom they judged unmodern, wounding egos as they did so, and sparking some lively literary debates. As long as satirists steered clear of politics, colonial authorities, and the monarchy, French censors focused their attention elsewhere. To defeat the Confucian tradition, Vietnamese writers focused their novels on individuals trapped by the oppressive hierarchical system, tyrannical mothers-in-law, arranged marriages, and power-hungry mandarins. Already, by 1925, Hoang Ngoc Phac had latched on to the theme of true love in Vietnam's first modern novel, Tho Tham, in order to bring to life vividly the destructive nature of arranged marriages on individual lives and suggest why cultural change was indispensable to Vietnam's ability to enter the modern world. Phac has his beautiful heroine, Tho Tham, face the choice of staying with her true love and being happy, or bowing to her parents' wishes that she marry another and, thereby, strengthen the family's future fortunes. But Phac, in a twist, offers Tho Tham a way out. Rather than accepting her Confucian fate, and with it all chance of happiness, she escapes her dilemma through suicide, the ultimate expression of personal liberty. This was not the tale of Q. Other literary self-strengthening movement writers followed suit. In his popular novel, The Midst of Spring, Kai Hung used true love to unite his young couple, Lok and Mai, in order to set up the opposition between individual choice and a traditional culture's oppression. Lok's family forbids his marriage to Mai. His love for this woman cannot not be allowed to trump the strategic need to unite him with a provincial mandarin's daughter. Children were to obey their parents. They did not choose freely. Filial piety, or hiu, ensured order and stability within the family unit, in terms that would have drawn approval from many of the older generation in Europe as well as Asia. Locke's mother told her defiant son, "You're not satisfied, but I am satisfied. You must know that in marriage it's essential to look for a house of equal status. Do you intend to force me into a relationship with a bunch of country bumpkins? You're a boy without hue. Do you hear me?" Nat Lin launched a similar offensive in Breaking the Ties. Once again, a young, beautiful woman serves as the protagonist to frame the opposition between arranged marriage and the Confucian order on the one hand, and free love and individualism on the other. Her name is Luan. She falls deeply in love with one man, but cannot pursue her heart, as her family requires her to marry another, a bad man, and all in the name of Hugh. Lone accepts her fate, but in so doing descends into a nightmare as her mother-in-law and husband make her life a living hell. Rather than producing order and harmony, Loan's adherence to Yu produces the opposite effect. While her husband cheats on her, her mother-in-law covers for him and exploits her at every turn. When Loan finally comes before a jury on murder charges trumped up by her mother-in-law, Nat Lin can finally step in as the defense lawyer, explaining to his readers that this case is part of a bigger problem. Vietnamese society today is not the Vietnamese society of the 19th century. The Vietnamese family cannot be left intact to be exactly like the Vietnamese families of previous centuries. In all the countries of the Far East, Japan, China, Thailand, and especially in China, the original ancestor of Asian civilization, the status of the family is not as it was before. Nat Ling sums up his defense of Luan. "These people who have absorbed the new culture have been imbued with ideas of humanity and individual freedom, so quite naturally they seek to escape from that system. This desire is very legitimate." The jury declares her not guilty. She and the generation she represents could finally walk free. Poets also broke with Confucian social constraints and Sino-Vietnamese literary forms that had governed poetry in the East Asian civilizational world for centuries. Several, but not all, started to use toi, the I personal pronoun, in order to free up the expression of the individual self from the oppression of family hierarchies and conventional social relations. True love again served as a popular model for setting up the opposition between old and new, traditional and modern. Phan Khoi drew the immediate praise of TLVD poets with the publication of his iconoclastic free verse poem in 1932 called Old Love. In a few beautiful lines, he evokes the chance meeting of the two lovers long after their decision to part ways in order to accept their arranged marriages. 24 years later, a chance encounter far away. Both heads had turned to silver. Had they not known each other well, might they not have passed unknown? An old affair was recalled no more. It was just a glance in passing. There still are corners to the eyes. Some of the TLVD's best poets, Lu Trong Lu, Te Lu, Hui Can, Che Van Nien, Zuan Du, Hoi Tan, and others inside and outside the group, joined in the battle against Sino-Vietnamese poetic forms in favor of free verse, Western models, and large doses of individualism. This flowering became widely known as the New Poetry Movement. Xian Yu was one of the movement's stars. The son of a schoolteacher, he published over 400 poems and many essays and literary critiques. His artistic originality springs forth from the first lines of his poem, "Still Too Far Away." The other day you stayed too far away from me, so I asked you to move over a bit closer. You inched over closer, but I demurred. To be a good girl, you inched still closer. As I was boiling over in haste with a smile, you scooted closer, soothing, "Here I am." I brightened up, then scowled at once, for I thought you were still too far away. Jean Dieu pushed the envelope like few others at the time. In Boy's Love, he wrote approvingly of the homoerotic love between the French romantic poets Rimbaud and Verlaine, drunk with exotic verse and with passion, defying worn paths and old ways. His former classmate from Hanoi, Hoi Can, joined him in taking Vietnamese poetry in new ways. Their homosexuality not only raised Confucian eyebrows, but the communists later forced Jean Dieu to correct his sexuality through intense rectification that almost destroyed him. The creation of the Academy of Fine Arts in Hanoi in 1925 introduced Western notions of art and their accompanying techniques, including oil painting, to Vietnam. Victor Tardieu, the Academy's first director, was determined to transform the indigenous craftsmen into professional artists. Vietnamese graduates of the Academy, such as Nguyen Gia Tri, Bui Gian Phai, Bo Nac Van, and others, borrowed Western techniques, oil painting in particular, and often imitated French models. But they also adapted them to explore very Vietnamese problems, such as individualism, love, gender differences, nationalism, politics, and the opposition between tradition and modernity. Thon Ngoc Van contributed regularly to the literary self-strengthening movement's newspapers. Like many poets and writers, several painters trained during the colonial period put their art in the service of national liberation after 1945. Some joined the communists and mobilized their art as part of a wider transformation of state and society. Thon Ngoc Van led many graduates of the Fine Arts Academy into the resistance. He died of the injuries he sustained during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and is today considered one of the country's greatest heroes for his sacrifice. However, Bui Gian Phai's call for artistic freedom in the wake of that historic victory landed him in trouble with the communists, who were intent on defining and controlling art. He lost his teaching position in the School of Fine Arts and had to wait until the 1980s to display his work in public again. Cultural Revolution, Widening and Humanizing Vietnamese Society. As important as the artists of the literary self-strengthening movement were, they cannot serve to sum up all the cultural transformations occurring in Vietnam at this time. Many derided the literary movement for its unbridled romanticism and obsession with Western modernity when pressing social and political issues clamored for attention. What about the downtrodden, the working class, the domestics, the faceless people without whom the modernization of the cities would not have got very far? What about the peasants and agricultural laborers who, collectively, constituted 90% of Vietnam's population? The advent of the left-wing Popular Front government, 1936-8, reinforced such social concerns in literary circles, as did loosening constraints on publishing in the North. Vo Nguyen Giap and Truong Chinh took advantage of this to publish their treatise called The Peasant Question in 1938. Southern communists and Trotskyists associated with La Lutte published investigations of working-class life. To be fair, the TLVD's leaders had also ventured into politics and begun to move their urban cultural revolution in more social and rural directions. The literary self-strengthening movement's authors were by no means insensitive to the rural life and its problems. They investigated dire peasant poverty, rural indebtedness, and illiteracy. Some of the best social realism, however, came from remarkable independent journalists like Nguyen Hong, Nguyen Khang Hon, and Tam Lang. During the 1930s, Tam Lang moved among the down and out of Hanoi. He described in memorable prose the poor, their lives, their hopes, their trials, and, sometimes, their tribulations. He disguised himself as a rickshaw driver for months in order to show to his urban, mainly middle-class readers the destinies of thousands of their compatriots trudging along every day like animals. "Society is to blame," Tam Leng concluded his classic piece of reportage. "I pulled a rickshaw." Yes, you and me, all of us, are equally at fault. To lower a powerless person from his status as a human being to that of a horse, to give him two wooden shafts and say, "I will sit up here while you pull me," is the same as saying, "You are not a human being." Tam Leng pointed out that the Human Rights League, Ligue des Droits de l'Homme, had tried to prevent the use of rickshaws during the colonial exhibition in France in 1931. Why could the Vietnamese not do this in their own society, he asked. At the heart of the question was once again the matter of individual rights. Some of the most sophisticated, penetrating, and original literature came from the burning pen of one eccentric, opium-addicted gadfly named Vu Trung Phung. His articles, investigative reports, and novels covered topics ranging from poverty, prostitution, and disease to sports, fashion, and love. He could move from biting social satire to outrageous humor in the space of a few lines. The originality of his social commentary comes through brilliantly in Luck Z, Dispensary, his newspaper column about venereal disease and prostitution in colonial Hanoi, as it does in his satirical and often side-splitting take on modern bourgeois society in his story Dumb Luck. Like Tam Leng, Vu Trung Phung investigated the individual lives of those who had never received any attention. He also knew the poor because he moved among them. He despised armchair social scientists, especially those who intellectualized about these people and their societies without knowing them. A rickshaw puller knows all the cruelty of human beings far better than a scholar. A room boy knows more about the debauchery of humanity than a surgeon. A servant understands more clearly the behavior of human beings than a realist writer. He ends his social realist reportage on household servants by turning the tables on his bourgeois readers and asking them to investigate themselves. The Vietnamese Communist Party later banned his books, writing him off as a depraved mind. He was probably 20th century Vietnam's greatest literary artist and social critic. A brilliant mind, he died in 1939 at the age of 27. One of the biggest changes in individual liberties to occur in colonial Vietnam was the expansion of women's rights. While many have insisted that Vietnam differed culturally from China in its empowerment of women down through the centuries, recent research suggests a less optimistic picture. The Lê Lạc Code did allow couples to separate, but divorce had to be mutually consented to. If the husband disagreed, there was no divorce. Legally, the husband, followed by the son, remained in control of land, and no real estate could change hands without male consent. Inheritance was legally stacked in favor of men. The Gia Long Law Code of the early 19th century reversed many of the advantages women had enjoyed under the earlier one, while the Confucian-based examination system codified inequality by banning women from undertaking the examinations to become civil servants, and thus from entry into positions of power. The ending of the examination system in Cochin China in the 1860s and Annam Tonkin in 1919, and the widening of the colonial education system to include Vietnamese girls, stimulated important changes in gender relations and empowered women in notable ways. Following Meiji Japan's example, the reform-minded creators of the Tonkin Free School allowed women to join them. By opening its doors to women, the Franco-Vietnamese schools had the biggest impact of all by increasing their literacy. This was revolutionary, for few Vietnamese women had ever had the chance to master classical characters or participate in the East Asian cultural world, an all-male club. Literacy in Quoc Ngu and, to a lesser degree, in French, opened up new realms of knowledge, offered new career tracks, and allowed women to voice and promote their interests in unprecedented ways. Many put pen to paper as journalists, poets, writers, and newspaper editors. Southern journalists led the way in widely read women's dailies like the Phụ Nữ Than Văn, Women's Modern News, and the Phụ Nữ Thời Đại, Women's Modern Times. They attacked Confucian constraints on women's rights in the family and wider society. Articles discussed whether widows should be allowed to remarry, spouses to divorce, and polygamy to continue. Women's associations, charities, and self-help groups multiplied during the interwar period. Groups for Girl Scouts appeared, joining the associations for Boy Scouts already in operation. As mandatory physical education spread in schools, young women joined their male counterparts in exercising their bodies. Madame Huang Xuan Han pioneered the development of women's tennis in Vietnam. Others entered into revolutionary politics and paid dearly for their activities. The French executed the female communist leader Nguyen Thi Minh Khai. One of the best historians of Vietnam today, Professor Wei Tam Ho Thai, has provided us with a riveting account of the trials and tribulations of revolutionary women in the person of her aunt, Bao Luang. However, the liberation bourgeois women experienced in urban areas was not necessarily replicated in the countryside, where male mandarins and rich landowners could run roughshod over women's rights. Many abusive mandarins had several wives and subjected them to terrible existences. Rape went largely unpunished. The literary self-strengthening movement's Cai Hung wrote searing critiques of such matters. Colonial law could do little about these abuses of women, given that the protectorate status of Annam and Tonkin kept the Gia Long Code in operation there until the late 1930s. The termination of the Confucian exam system did little to change village politics and councils, which remained largely in the hands of men under the French. Gender equality for French settler women was hardly better. A French woman could not run for office in the Cochin Chinese Colonial Council. There was never one female French commissioner at any level of the Indochinese bureaucracy during the entire colonial period. The director of the École Française d'Extrême-Orient under Vichy, Georges Coed, used Vichy's anti-Semitic laws to get rid of the only female member of this organization, and a very illustrious one at that, Suzanne Capel. And French women, like their colonized sisters, only received the right to vote in France after the Second World War. Cultural Revolution in Post-Colonial Vietnam's War, the State, and Individual Freedom. Decades of war deeply affected Vietnamese culture and individual liberties. Between 1940, when the Japanese began occupying Tonkin, and 1991, when the Paris Peace Accords finally ended the conflicts over Indochina, war mobilized, politicized, and militarized Vietnamese culture as a wide range of actors went to battle over the country's soul. The French fought hard to maintain a colonial culture against those who sought to replace it with a nationalist one. The Japanese tried to force their own imperial propaganda upon Indochina during the Second World War, before the Cold War's superpowers, the United States, the Soviet Union, and China, next tried to export their own cultural diplomacies in Vietnam. It worked the other way, too. Although Ho Chi Minh and Ngo Dinh Diem presided over the nationalization of their respective states within Vietnam, they also tried to adapt foreign ideologies to local needs. Ho's entourage adapted a foreign Sino-Soviet communist ideology to the north, while Diem's family tried to tailor French personalism to the social realities in the south. All of this built on earlier strata of intertwined cultural, religious, and ideological adaptations discussed earlier on in this book, reaching back for centuries in the form of all sorts of isms. The poverty of French colonial culture. From start to finish, colonial culture was very much an official enterprise designed to legitimate French conquest and rule to both the vanquished Vietnamese and the French people in France, who cared very little about their empire. This lack of interest at home was such that the French government brought the colonies to the metropolis in a series of colonial exhibitions, culminating in the extraordinary reproduction of the French Empire in miniature outside Paris in 1931. Colonial culture also evolved in reaction to external competition for Vietnamese hearts and minds. If Paul Bo established the Indochinese University in Hanoi in 1908, he did so because Vietnamese students were going abroad to study in Tokyo rather than Paris. Other sets of colonizers asserted their influence too. The Japanese, for example, tried to replace the Chinese at the center of a centuries-old East Asian civilization and were often in a more favorable position than the French in their ability to influence Asian opinions. The Japanese defeat of the Russian Navy in 1905 only reinforced the sense of their might and thus their potential to influence the Vietnamese, as did their own colonial propaganda machine. In the lead-up to the First World War, the Germans also expounded their propaganda throughout Asia, in Chinese and English. And the Americans were in there, too. French security services carefully monitored American Protestant missionaries in Vietnam during the 1920s, while censors tried to limit news of Washington's creation of the Commonwealth of the Philippines in 1935, as this was the Philippines' first step toward full independence. All of these factors led the French to accelerate their own propaganda efforts. Indeed, the origins of the French Francophonie project are not to be found only in the decolonization of the 1960s, as is so often claimed, but rather in this earlier inter-imperial cultural competition. The outbreak of the Second World War in China in 1937 and the Japanese entry into Tonkin in September 1940 brought this competition directly to Indochina on unfavorable terms for the French. The humiliating defeat of the Third Republic in June 1940, followed by France's official collaboration with Hitler and condominium with Germany's Asian ally Japan, cost the French authorities dearly in the eyes of the Vietnamese. Determined to maintain the fiction of Franco-Vietnamese collaboration, the new Governor-General, Jean de Caux, reactivated the cultural front through the expansion of youth mobilization campaigns, sporting events, and by allying local patriotisms with Vichy's Révolution Nationale. Even the leader of Vichy France, Marshal Philippe Pétain, found himself dressed in full Vietnamese Confucian garb on the front page of one Vietnamese paper in 1943. Missing from this return to the past, however, was the colonial emperor Bao Dai, and the very Vietnamese elites who had transformed culture and, with it, individual liberty in such profound ways during the interwar period. Focused on more pressing matters during the Second World War, the Japanese were content to rule Indochina indirectly through the French and accorded the French governor, General Jean de Caux, a free hand on the cultural front in exchange for his continued political, economic, and administrative collaboration with them. However, this did not stop the Japanese from promoting their own imperial ideology and propaganda within Vietnam through the creation of cultural associations, newspapers, and limited study abroad. While de Caux monopolized the mobilization of urban youth, the Japanese launched their cultural offensive on the religious front in rural areas of Vietnam, mainly among the followers of the Cao Dai and the Hoa Hao Buddhist faiths in the south. The thinness of Vichy's colonial culture was laid bare for all to see on the 9th of March 1945, when the Japanese finally overthrew the French and, with them, their colonial state. Many Vietnamese lost no time developing what had been in the making for decades, a Vietnamese national culture. Thanks to print media, the expansion of Quoc Ngu, and the access to globalizing ideas that had been developing for half a century, thousands of Vietnamese began decolonizing their culture with astonishing alacrity. Newspapers, radios, telegraphs, and photos spread the news of the end of 80 years of French rule. Colonial monuments came tumbling down. Street names changed from French colonial ones to those of Vietnamese national heroes as composers scrambled to create a national anthem. Nguyen Thai Hoc, the leader of the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, whom the French had guillotined in 1931 for demanding an independent republic, finally received a carefully ritualized resurrection and public homage in June 1945. The photographer Vo An Ninh captured these events on the covers of the Trung Bac Tan Van, Northern Central News. Upon taking over a few months later, Ho Chi Minh continued in the same vein, saluting young scouts, solemnly visiting national shrines, and taking charge of a whole host of cultural associations, presses, newspapers, schools, and radios. He had competition from non-communist nationalists, however, especially when well-known individuals like Nhat Linh and Cai Hung returned to Hanoi determined to promote a nationalist culture as well as an anti-communist one. Since the start of the Pacific War, these men had joined Nguyen Thai Hoc's party, the Vietnamese Nationalist Party, and now opened a new paper in Hanoi, Vietnam. Heated exchanges broke out as Vietnamese nationalists argued over the nature of post-colonial Vietnam. Meanwhile, colonial war spread across the South as Charles de Gaulle's troops began reconquering the Mekong Delta in late 1945. From the start, all three sides—communists, nationalists, and colonialists—mobilized, politicized, and militarized culture like never before, via print culture, cinema, and the airwaves. Cultural Revolution, War and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, 1945-75. The outbreak of full-scale hostilities in Hanoi in late 1946 between the French and the Vietnamese saw the French embark upon a bloody war of colonial conquest. French artillery and bombers reduced much of the old quarter in Hanoi to rubble, sending the population fleeing into the countryside. Unlike in the 19th century, however, foreign correspondents and diplomats monitored this second conquest closely. And despite their efforts to shape public opinion by emphasizing the three pillars of the colonial gesture, the creation of hospitals, schools, and roads, and the horrors committed by the other side, the French press and propaganda services could never stop their critics, not even those coming from inside the colonial office, from challenging the premises of colonial ideology in war. In 1949, the head of the Colonial Academy in Paris, Paul Mou, dropped a bombshell when he published a series of articles condemning the army's use of torture and calling for French negotiations with Ho Chi Minh. He lost his job and ended up in Yale, where he helped get Southeast Asian studies off the ground and influenced the anti-war movement in the United States. One Frances Fitzgerald met him there. Her Pulitzer Prize-winning attack on the American war in Vietnam, Fire in the Lake, is dedicated to Mou. Emile D'Antonio's In the Year of the Pig, nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature in 1969, owes much to Mou, one of the few French intellectuals to have spoken out against the First Indochina War. In this film, one can hear D'Antonio's French Orientalist expert defend Ho Chi Minh passionately, insisting that he was the rightful heir to a timeless Confucian tradition and resistance culture. Culture remained a battlefield, too, because French colonial conquest was never complete during the entire First Indochina War. Ho Chi Minh's Democratic Republic of Vietnam continued to exist as a state, controlling 10 million people spread across wide tracts of territory by the end of that war. From its capital in the northern hills to its control over much of central Vietnam, Ho's lieutenants contested every colonial attempt to influence Vietnamese, Asian, and foreign opinion. The government's diplomatic delegations in Bangkok, Rangoon, New Delhi, Prague, and Paris organized interviews with foreign correspondents, countered French propaganda, and promoted their own. The Ministry of Education and Culture, in collaboration with the Vietnamese Workers' Party, presided over the continued